This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Coming up, Subversity. Foxy's bear, eat the rich. Show your stomach you can, eat the rich. Pull the rich ass lane, spreading out the problem, but we know who's to blame. And I'm tired of hearing it loud, best if I can, eat the rich. Yum, yum, yeah, eat the rich. Yum, yum, yeah. Chemicals in your food, eat the rich. Yum, yum, yeah. Don't you think that that's rude? Gone, eat the rich. Yum, yum, yeah. Oh, the rich has the flower, I think it's a shame. Spreading out the problem, but we know who's to blame. And I'm tired of living in love. Best of the game, eat the rich. Welcome to another edition of Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. Today we're going to take a look back at the Gulf War as America continues its invasion of Iraq. And with us on the phone is Joyce Riley, who is with a group of American Gulf War Veterans Association. Welcome, Joyce.
Thank you very much, Dan. It's my pleasure.
Yeah, thank you for being on the show. You have some kind of skepticism about the reason why we end this war.
Well, I think that what we have to do is look back to the first Gulf War, and what has happened is a very unfortunate situation. Those of us who volunteered, those of us who were dedicated and to serve, we made out our wills and we said, I'm ready to go. We did it because we believed it was the right thing. Now, regardless of how uninitiated and uneducated I was at the time, that's a decision I made. My father served, military, everything, be a flight nurse more than anything, and that's what I had been doing, or I had been commissioned as a flight nurse in the Air Force in 1979 in the reserves. So when the war came along and I heard that story about the incubator babies, you recall that story, Dan, about throwing the babies on the incubator, on the cold floor? Do you recall that?
Right. They testified before Congress, right?
Correct. Well, that story is what drove me to say, okay, that's it. I'm going to go. I can't stand this story. I can't stand to hear what's going on here. So I went back to Kelly Air Force Base, and I said, I want to go to Saudi Arabia. Well, most of my unit had already left at that point, and I was coming back from a job. I was a heart, lung, liver, kidney transplant nurse at the time, and so I made the decision to go active reserve and to serve, only because of that story, because of that 15-year-old girl, Nayero, that went before Congress and testified before Representative Lantos's committee, saying that they were throwing the babies on the floor and they allowed them to die and they were bayoneting. Oh, it was horrible. It was just a horrible story. But that story turned out to be false. It turned out to be worse than false. It was a fraud. George Bush repeated it. Lantos repeated it. Lots of people repeated it. I mean, George Bush over and over again, George Bush Sr. would say that the horrible atrocities of the Iraqis. Well, I believed it because I never before that time ever questioned my government, my military at all, period. Well, as a result of that story, I got 10 shots in one day, and it changed my life forever because of the vaccines that I received. And 6 months later, or about a year later, I was hospitalized with a demyelinating disorder to multiple sclerosis. Cure it. Then we found that the satellite photos showing that the tanks were amassed at the border of Saudi Arabia, 1,000 Iraqi tanks were supposed to be amassed at the border. That turned out to be inaccurate. Then we were told that April Glaspie gave them tacit approval, the ambassador to Iraq, gave tacit approval for Saddam Hussein to go into Kuwait, and at that point just basically opened the door for them. So all these stories we started finding out were false.
Well, the baby one was actually the production of a PNR firm, right? Public
That's
relations
right.
firm.
That was Hill & Knowlton Advertising Agency. And that public relations, war should not be fought by an advertising agency. I'm sorry. It should not be fought by a public relations group. And so I was hoodwinked. And in fact, in Senate Report 103-900, which is called the Regal Report now, and has actually been taken off the government printing office list. We do have some, you go to the internet and you can find, just put in 103-900 and the Senate committee, and I think it'll probably bring it up and give you some information. It's about 600 pages long. But this document is full of the information that the government doesn't want people to read about what happened during the first Gulf War. Hill & Knowlton Advertising Agency is cited in there as having been paid to produce this false, fraudulent story. Now, we're not just talking about hoodwinking people, which is what it said. And the girl was Laura Fitzpagato, was the girl in charge of this. She was vice president of Hill & Knowlton Advertising Agency. And they were paid $10.5 million to put together the fraud on the American people. And that's what it says in the document.
And she works at the Commerce Department now.
That's exactly. Very good. You've done your homework. Yes, she was, well, she was given a position change to which she became an executive in the Commerce Department, and now she's back with the Laura Fitzpagato Group as her own public relations group now. But you see, these frauds started coming, you know, to light after the Gulf War. Now, those of us, I mean, a flight nurse or a ground pounder, a combat engineer, you know, we didn't know anything about any of this stuff. Our country said go. We said, you bet. And so we were taken advantage of. We found out also that there were lots of experimental drugs used, not just the ones they're telling you about, but there were a number of military came back very sick. There's nobody sick. Everything's fine. Don't complain. You're probably a head case if you do. And so we started seeing all these people with multiple sclerosis, young men, 19 years old, coming back with MS. I got it myself, but it's more common in females, so I didn't think much about it until I realized, wait a minute, the other nurses are coming back with this also. So we are talking about a major fraud, a major crime that has been perpetrated on the American military by the fact that they tested on us with proprietary pharmaceutical companies or for these proprietary pharmaceutical companies. And we now have, Dan, 400,000 sick Gulf War veterans out of the 700,000 that are sick. And it is a tragedy.
That's an amazing number of people. And wasn't there also use of depleted uranium in the weaponry that was used to blow up these Iraqi tanks?
Well, there was a massive amount, 40,000 tons of, 40 tons of depleted uranium went into that desert over there. The depleted uranium, for anybody who's not familiar with it, is a very dense, penetrating material. It is much more dense than lead, and so it's used to basically go through a tank like butter. And it's shot by an M1A1 main battle tank and also by the A-10 that shoots it in a 30-millimeter shell. So it when it is shot, they want it to penetrate a tank, and it would have penetrated those Iraqi tanks, went right through them. But the problem is the dust off of that, or the particulate matter, is so small and micron in size, that what it does is if you breathe it into your lungs, then you get that depleted uranium in your lungs, and you're poisoned. Radiologically, you're poisoned for the rest of your life because there is no way to get it out. Now, that's what happened to thousands and thousands of Gulf War veterans because they did a survey and found out that about 80% of the troops that went into Iraq had had gone into the tanks because a lot of people wanted to get souvenirs or they wanted to go in and see the tanks. And when they did, they got exposed to that stuff. Also, the Navy vessels, we found that many of the Navy troops are sick because of the SABO rounds and some of the phalanx project, and they would get it from the shells on the naval ship. So we had a number of people exposed. Now, the half-life of depleted uranium is 4.5 billion, with a B, years.
Yeah.
Now it's even worse what's happening in the Persian Gulf. I understand it's even worse depleted uranium. It's being used also, or it was used, I understand, in Afghanistan and also in Yugoslavia. Now, the problem with this is that the military really had not told any of its people about the dangers of DU. So during the Gulf War, all these guys, 19-year-old kids, jumping out of their tanks and running into the enemy tank to look at it, to get souvenirs, whatever, to see if the enemy was dead for whatever reason. And all this dust is blowing all over the desert. Well, they sent a gentleman named Dr. Doug Roeke over to the desert to clean this up. He was an expert physicist, and they gave him the job of cleaning up depleted uranium. He didn't know anything really about DU, and he found out, though, that there was absolutely no way to clean it up, and it was a done deal. So he was commissioned by the Department of Defense to make a video talking about depleted uranium. But unfortunately, they never played it. And what he knew and learned about depleted uranium was that this training film was telling the truth about DU, and the DOD never showed it to the troops because it was that bad. So now we have these young men that have lungs about the consistency of those of an 80-year-old, and there's nothing that can be done with them. They have been poisoned radiologically.
Do you know what they're using now in this war?
They're using depleted uranium, but I got a call from London, from the Gulf War Veterans Association in London, and they told me that it is five times more serious or more DU in the item. Now, I don't know that for a fact, but the European people are very upset about it. Also, by the way, American Gulf War Veterans Union, of which I am the spokesperson, has dissented on this war, and we have been joined by the British Gulf War Veterans Association. But even though the New York Times has called me and Newsweek and all the major press in this country, not one of them will print the fact that both of the veterans groups are dissenting on the war in this country. And they don't want it known, basically, because of the information that we now have.
So there is a problem with media coverage.
Oh, there's a horrendous problem. It's called, I asked one of the producers of one of the major news networks that contacted me. You would recognize, obviously, the network, and I just don't want to say who it was because I think she was being very frank with me. She called me and wanted to know some information on the Gulf War, and I told her the truth about it. And I said, look, like I do to everybody just about, do you want to know the truth or do you want to know the prevailing appropriate story that I'm supposed to tell you? And she says, no, give me the truth. And then they say, but you know I can't print it. And so I said, now, let me ask you this. Why can't you print this story? And she said, because we cannot go against the prevailing domestic policy. We are not allowed to present anything that differs from the prevailing domestic. And I said, well, you understand the responsibility of the media is to be basically the a check and balance of the government and to let us know what's happening. She said the control is so great that there's only going to be two people that will be speaking out in the mainstream. One of them will be on PBS, Bill Moyers, and the other one is going to be Amy Goodman on Democracy Now. She said, other than that, you will not hear anybody in the major network or the major media that will be dissenting on the war. And she said, and by the way, she said, all the reporters listen to Amy Goodman on Democracy Now.
For the truth.
I thought that was kind of interesting.
You know, it's kind of weird because, you know, look at all the troops, all the generals that are embedded in the, you know, different battalions. And I was thinking that maybe they're in bed with the various...
I think we should read that, in bed.
Right.
And I do think that's exactly what that means. And I think that they have become very clever about the terms that they use. And that's exactly what it is. They now have 573 media people that are in bed with the government. And that they are literally telling the story as they wanted it presented. But, you know, I've got to tell you, Dan, I think that this war is giving the Bush administration a little bit of a headache because I don't think this real-time TV coverage is exactly what they planned on. I think this weekend is an example.
Right.
I mean, horrendously devastating to anybody in the military to have watched that or to anybody's family members that watched that. It was beyond, I couldn't even watch it. It was horrendous.
You're talking about the POW pictures and...
talking about, number one, our Patriot missile shooting down a British aircraft, about a gentleman from the 101st Airborne killing his own members of his troops. You know, when I first saw that, the question came to my mind, now, wait a minute, how did somebody breach the perimeter? I mean, we're talking about 101st Airborne. These guys have real guns, and they know how to use them. You know, where is their perimeter? That's what military is for. They mark off their perimeter, and they have it guarded 24 hours a day. How did this happen? And then, of course, when we heard that it was somebody from their own unit, you know, this is horribly embarrassing to the 101st Airborne. They're an incredible unit. But I've got to tell you, they are a new unit, a brand-new unit since the first Gulf War. And a lot of it has to do with this fact. Now, this is something else that the media will not print. Although I've told everybody about it, every major media, I mean, I've told, well, anyway, we don't have to name them all, we know who they are, is that number one, 90% of the people that served in Desert Storm were out by 1995. 90%. They were sick. They had to leave, or else the government knew they were going to be sick and the military didn't want them a part of them. They did not want the Marines to start looking sick, so they outed them. For instance, if one person, we had one situation where somebody gained 1 pound over the weight limit, and they knew that they were going to be sick. They knew that they were had been exposed, and so they got them out of the military on 1 pound over the weight limit. You know, if that had happened to General Schwarzkopf during the war, we would have never had him as a leader, because he obviously did not appear to fit, you know, in the weight limit, but it was okay for certain people.
Did he get sick, though?
Yes, he did.
He did?
Yes, huh. He did. He was treated for prostate cancer after the Gulf War, and a lot of people have come down with cancer subsequent to the Gulf War. I'm not making any causation relationship here at all,
okay.
And I'm not saying that he got sick as a result of that. I've heard some other stories that he has been sick, similar to Gulf War veterans, but I don't know anything that would be considered fact.
Right.
But 90% of the Gulf War veterans were out. Now, Colin Powell said in his book, An American Journey, that after the Gulf War, there would be a 25% downsizing. We had 90%. And by the Gulf War, now, 95% of the people that served in Desert Storm are out of the military. Now, the person that gave me this figure in 1995 was Senator Wellstone's office. One day we were playing a game of you tell me what you know and I'll tell you what I know with Bill Siebenhaler of his office, who was very supportive in trying to get help and the truth about the Gulf War illness. And he committed to us that it was a known fact that 90% were out by 95. Now think about that. You had a war in 91, a 100-hour war, and all of a sudden 90% of your military walks away and says, I'm done, I've had it. It's a professional military. They came in for careers. They wanted to retire, and they didn't.
What's the reaction of the VA, the Veterans Administration, to all this?
Veterans Administration is literally a puppet of the Department of Defense, so they have to do anything and everything the DOD says. For instance, the Department of Defense says there is no Gulf War illness. That's the official position of the DOD right now. There's no Gulf War illness. Oh, yeah, we've got some joint pain and some rashes and a bunch of head cases out there, but, you know, nothing really to worry about. So because the DOD says that, the Veterans Administration cannot treat for something that does not exist. So here's how they get around it, and I know it's especially true at the LAVA, is if you go in there and you're complaining of headaches, you get something to treat headaches. If you complain of gastrointestinal problems, which Gulf War veterans have, you get something to treat that, Prilosec, or something to treat your gastrointestinal problem, or something for diarrhea, or whatever your symptomatic relief is. If you have joint pain, you get massive doses of ibuprofen that'll knock your liver out if you're not careful. So that's how they treat it. If you come in with sleep deprivation, unable to sleep, night sweats, then you get a whole bunch of really good things that will really zonk you. If you go into a VA hospital, the first thing they do, though, is they give you a psychiatric evaluation. And the purpose behind that, of course, is if you give anybody a psychiatric evaluation, you can pretty well find something on them. I mean, if you ask enough questions the right way, you're going to be able to label them. And that's what happens with all these psychological interns that do this. Let me give you an example. We had one recruiter. He had been 20 years in the military. He was 16 years in the military. He wanted to retire there. He was an absolute excellent candidate. I mean, excellent Marine. He was poster board Marine. And as a result of serving in the Gulf War, he became unable to take care of himself. I mean, I cannot believe what happened to this poor man. And because he was in recruiting, they could kind of like help him along. But he became incontinent. And it was horrendously embarrassing. A lot of guys became incontinent, and that was probably why they had to leave the military first, because they couldn't even function. So this guy goes to the VA, and bless his heart, he goes to the VA, and he tells them his problem, and they say, well, we need to give you a psych eval. So they take him in for the psychiatric evaluation, and they ask him, have you ever been depressed? And he said, yeah, when my mom died when I was 12 years old, it was really hard on me. I was kind of sad for a while. Bingo. Post-traumatic stress disorder related to mother's death. So that's how they canned him, was based on the fact that, hey, you don't have anything wrong with you from the Gulf War. You're still trying to get over your mother's death. Now, this is unconscionable. Dan, this is horrendous to do this to these men. this man has become so sick as a he is extremely ill. But I think worst of all is he feels like he was a bad Marine. And so when we got a hold of him and were able to talk with him and let him know what was happening, that there were thousands of other Gulf War veterans just like him, you know, it makes it a lot easier. But still, there's no compensation. You can't compensate something that doesn't exist. And so we have these guys. Let me give you another example. We had a man who had been in for 22 years, and he was a senior master. He started having weakness in his legs. Now, this is where I really have a problem with the LAVA, because they started getting a lot of guys there that would come in and say, I'm having weakness in my hands and legs. And these guys were all told the same thing. Wow, this is the first case we've ever seen like this. We found out that at the LAVA alone, there were something like 700 people they told that to. I mean, that is unbelievable that we would create this kind of a fraud with these troops that did the right thing.
So it sounds like a conspiracy.
It is a conspiracy by intent. Now, I've talked to the DOD, and I've told them. Now, Department of Defense, they say we have $300 million we've spent at this, Joyce. We spent $300 million. We've tried everything to get to the bottom of this. And I say, well, then either you have the worst scientific people in the world, or 12 years later, it is by intent. And I said, I believe at this point it is obviously by intent. And back to this gentleman who was 22 years in the service and started losing the use of his legs. He went in to the VA hospital, and they said, well, you know, we'll have to give him a Psych-Eval to his wife. And he had been in there several times, and he called me before he was going to go to the hospital this time, and he said, I'm in a wheelchair now. He said, they're going to have to treat me now and understand I can't walk. So he went into the VA in a wheelchair. They'd given him the Psych-Eval, et cetera. The doctor comes in, a regular family practice doctor, comes in and says to his wife, we need to tell you something. Your husband is not sick from the Gulf War. We did a Psych-Eval on him, and he's really a latent homosexual. And if he would just admit it, walk again. And she went for that doctor. I mean, she was so mad at him. She did not believe that. His children standing there. And as a result of that, she got thrown out of the hospital, and he had to go seek treatment elsewhere. But that's what we're doing to our troops.
So they have to find private insurance or what?
Well, you can't get private insurance because you've got a pre-existing problem. So, number one, if they can find any kind of work, then sometimes they can get some coverage.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these people do not have any insurance whatsoever. They become homeless. They have to go back to the VA, and the VA now admits them to psychiatric units if they complain about Gulf War illness, because that means they're delusional since there is no Gulf War illness.
It sounds like a nightmare, a movie, you know.
It is a nightmare. It is a horrendous nightmare. And the problem is a lot of these guys end up committing suicide because they are a liability on the family. They feel as though they are. They feel as though they can't function. After a while, you know, we can talk about the Gulf War illness and what it is and who's the sickest and why they got it. But after a while, these people that were in Iraq, you see, chemicals were used in that Gulf War. Ladies and gentlemen, whether you want to believe it or not, chemicals were used.
Who used it? The Department
of Defense knows it.
Who used it?
The Iraqis and the United States. We have 15,000 chemical alarms that went off during the Gulf War. 15,000. Now, the interesting thing, and let me give you an answer. Now, the United States used it, but I don't know to what extent. Now, I've been given a lot of good information as to the troops, how it was used. There were chemical landmines and some other things, but not to the extent that the Iraqis used it. But listen to this, and this comes right from a report that we were not supposed to get a copy of, but if you go to GulfWarVets.com, www.GulfWarVets.com, we've got a bookstore, and documents are on there that have all been taken off the government printing office, and this one is called the Interim Report. It was dated September 9th of 1993. Now, remember, the war was 91, and by 93, already they had this, and it's been war syndrome, the case for multiple origin mixed chemical biotoxin warfare-related disorders. And after the first Gulf War, they went in, and in 91, they found that there were chemical warfare agents all over that place. In fact, they found 13,000 155 millimeter artillery shells loaded with mustard gas. 6,200 rockets loaded with nerve agent, 800 nerve agent aerial bombs, 28 Scud warheads loaded with sarin, 75 tons of nerve agent sarin, 60 to 70 tons of Tabin, and 250 tons of mustard gas. So the United States government knows full well just how much exposure there was to our troops and knows that it was a significant amount of exposure. It was an offensive weapons program that they had. But that information started disappearing very fast because they also found that there had been 850,000 defective chemical suits given to our troops. Now, if you want to find out more about this, go into Google and check out Isratex, I-S-R-A-T-E-X, which is the company that made these. In 1989, they sold 850,000 suits with defects, holes, tears, seams ripped, to the Department of Defense.
Is it made in the U.S.? Or?
Yes, it was made in Raynell, West Virginia, by this company, Isratex. The government didn't check their material, obviously, and didn't find out about them, they say, until 1993, and we tried to go back to Isratex. They haven't been able to follow, or they have whatever they did, I don't know. But they came from Israel, though they were, it was an Israeli company. And I only say that because that's the way it's in the news media. But they could not find them, they said. And the United States government got stung for 850,000 defective suits. However, the real problem is our troops got exposed to chemical agents over there. And yet they're holding these poor two guys, pilots, on Article 15 charges and bringing them up on friendly fire charges and friendly fire deaths of the Canadian military. When our own military had defective chemical suits, the Department of Defense now knows it. You know, when you get a suit, you should check it out. The DOD should have people that are quality control, that are inspectors. You don't just buy a parachute and jump out of a plane without checking it. And they didn't check it.
Well, we're coming to the end of our first half hour. Let's reintroduce our guests. We're talking with Joyce Riley, who's with the American Gulf War Veterans Association, and this is Dan Zhang with Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on the show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. Joyce, one of the most startling statements you have on your website is that it was the U.S. that set off the oil well fires in the first Gulf War.
Well, what we say is that we have had five people that have come forward and said that they were, in fact, involved or had knowledge of the U.S. starting those oil well fires. Now, this is a very critical story, and it's becoming more critical by the day because the foreign press has gotten a hold of it, and they are not happy about this. They're doing a lot more investigation than I could have possibly done.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But let me just tell you that when I started getting reports about this and the troops would tell those, you know, in our unit that, you know, the Iraqis didn't start it. We were the ones there. Iraqis were back in Baghdad, the Republican Guard at that time. We found that there was information showing that, yes, there had been knowledge that the Kuwaiti oil company the field there had been bombed by Allied bombing. Now, we did find out that that was, in fact, true, and there were several investigations into that, but it never hit the public news. Until, you know, we had these four or five people that had come forward. Then we had one more person that came forward, but he was willing to sit down and do a transcript and tell us his story as to what happened. Now, none of these troops came forward saying, hey, boy, have I got a story for you. That wasn't the reason. They came forward because they had heavy hearts. They were concerned about what was happening with the buildup of this war. Many of them wanted to just clear their conscience. We've had deathbed testimonies of certain things that have taken place. And in this particular instance, this vet told us how it happened. Now, you can go and see the transcript at, I believe it's posted on Gulf War Vets, VETS.com, or thepowerhour.com, thepowerhour.com.
I tried to click on it yesterday, but it didn't. It just wasn't opening for some
reason. We got hacked big time. In fact, the hacker substituted a page for ours that had very foul language and was an obvious, had admitted to the hacking of our website. We've had a terrible time keeping it up because the documentation we have on there is what we consider primary source documentation, much of it. It comes from the documents. It's not my opinion, because my opinion doesn't count.
Mm-hmm.
But there is, it should either be up now or it should be up very soon, testimony.
What did he say?
He said basically that they were called into a briefing tent, and there he said 30 to 40 people were in the briefing tent. I asked him what services were represented, and he said that he recognized Delta Force, Marine Recon, and SEALs that were present there. I asked him who did the briefing, and he said it was a UN commander. They were then taken to where they were supposed to carry out their mission, at the oil fields. They went to the oil fields, and he told me exactly how they did it. They used C4 and explosives. They set the wells, and the remote detonation. They each had a transmitter of some type, of which they would let them know when they had set the wells, and then they would detonate them at a later time while they all egressed from the area. He said the one problem that they had was to get out of the way of the incoming of their own incoming troops, because they were coming into that area, and that is something that. You know, it was interesting because when we talked to the Marines that were first in, they told us they did not see any Republican Guard. Now, Republican Guard have a red V on their shoulder, so there's a patch that is very easy to see, and most of the people who told me that they never saw a Republican Guard during the time of the war.
What was this person with?
He didn't want to say.
Okay.
He didn't want to say which unit he was with, only because... Until some other people are willing to come forward, he wants protection, and I understand fully why he wants this.
But he's a veteran?
Yes. Yeah. He was one of those units that I just told you about, Marine Recon, SEAL, or Delta Force. He was one of those.
So this was like a black mission?
Yes.
Black ops?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. And this is not an indictment on the SEALs or on the Delta Force or on the Marine Recon. And I understand they were given a mission. They didn't understand why they were doing it. If you were told to go and set a well, maybe you would have thought it was for a defensive purpose or to troops or whatever. So I understand that at the time, they were given an order and they carried it out.
Why would the U.S. want to blow them up?
Well, there's been a couple of reasons that have been told to us by the people that were involved in this. Number one, it was because there was not enough negative sentiment against Saddam Hussein. And they needed this negative assessment and negative sentiment against him. The second reason was for concealment and cover in doing their missions. And that was just what was told to me, concealment and cover. So after the mission was done, and of course all those oil wells were set on fire, they egressed from the area, the other troops came in, and of course we know what happened for 6 months. They tried to put them out. Now, I found out more information. Now, after he had told me this, and we put up the testimony, I got hate mail like you cannot imagine. But it was from people that didn't understand from the outside, because a lot of people told me, well, we knew this all along.
Hmm.
It was plain knowledge that the fires had been started in that fashion. Then I found out this information. Two federal studies were released in January of 1991. Now, that's 1 month prior to the starting of the fires. The other thing that is interesting is that we cannot find the date this fire started, because we find several different dates. It's confused with the Allied bombing runs, because it now appears that those Allied bombing runs basically started the Kuwaiti oil field on fire. Then some of the wells were set to make it look like the Iraqis had done it in haste as they were leaving. But these two federal studies, Dan, that were released in January of 1991 were government studies done by the United States for environmental impact purposes. And they were released, and it's amazing to me. Nobody knew about this. These two reports predicted oil fire smoke and predicted the damage that was going to take place. Now, the first one was a Sandia Labs study in Livermore and Los Alamos National Laboratories for the Department of Energy. It was entitled Potential Impacts of Iraqi Use of Oil as a Defensive Weapon. Now, we all know that EI studies take an awful long time to produce. It's not something you go in your tent and you write overnight. These environmental impact studies are done many, many months in advance. This is what here's the basis of this study. Based on information we have received, a 20 million barrel crude oil spill to the Persian Gulf is possible near Kuwait's coast. 10 million barrels could be released in the first 24 hours, followed by another 10 million in the next 36 hours. That was one study. The second study was released on January 11th, prior to the starting of the fires, and it was an environmental impact of damage to Kuwaiti oil facilities by Pacific Sierra Research for the Defense Nuclear Agency. So here we had two studies predicting what was going to take place, or they had good reason to believe that Saddam might do this. But either way, Washington prevented negotiation of a peaceful settlement on at least three times, and they commenced an aerial assault on Iraq, and they failed to take preventive and control measures. Now, here is one other very important addition to this. According to the Associated Press, now this is a story done by Neil McFarquhar back in 1991 for the AP. The president of OGE Drilling, that was involved at that time as a cleanup company in the Gulf, the president's name was T.B. O'Brien. Now, O'Brien says, and this was in 1991, he is quoted as saying, "We are still waiting for heavy construction bulldozers, backhoes, cranes, and more than 300 trucks and a host of specialized smaller tools that were ordered in November of 1990. So they were really psychic. November of 1990, prior to this, they were knowledgeable about the fact that they were going to need all that equipment. So that information, coupled with some UN Security Council materials I was able to get a hold of. In fact, Dan, I don't know if you're aware of this or not. In fact, I'd like to ask you, because you're very bright, you're very on top of all of this. Were you aware that Iraq had denied all the time that they ever started those fires?
No, I read that on your website. No, I didn't know.
Well, it's interesting because the UN Security Council met up until October of 1990. October of 2002 issue about this. And we've got some links up there, and we're going to have more links on the oil well fire section. But the Security Council had a group called the United Nations Compensation Commission Governing Council, which met to try and determine what reparations would be for Iraq. Now, the interesting thing is that Iraq had always said, you know, there's no way we would start these fires because we didn't want to pay for them, because we knew we were going to have to make reparations. Well, we found that the U.S. government, Iraq had always denied that they had set the oil well fires. The only evidence that was brought before the Security Council, Compensation Commission Governing Council, was the following: newspaper articles, and the number two were some documents that they said were Iraqi military orders that the Iraqi military had dropped when they were running and leaving the oil well field. Now, I found this absolutely unbelievable. It reminded me of the passport that they found that dropped out of the 757 at the WTC. So here we have, allegedly, documents that are being left at the sea oil well fires. Number one, you would have thought the oil might have done some damage to those documents, number one, that's not the way we write our military orders in Iraq. Those are fraudulent documents. And I'm going to have it up on the website where it let me just see if I can find the wording of it here, because it's fascinating the way they worded this. I believe it is, the document is up there. It's about 100 pages long, and it's section 40. They say that they were military orders that they state were left behind by the retreating Iraqi forces. And, of course, the Iraqis say that they had planted absolutely no explosives at all. And according to Iraq, somebody working, now this is before the UN Security Council, according to Iraq, somebody working for the interest of Iraq's enemies planted explosives in order to incriminate Iraq and throw the responsibility of the firing of oil wells on the Iraq armed forces. Now, Iraq argues as follows, and there's several statements that they argue about. Now, granted, if I had started the fires, I'd be saying I didn't do it either, because, you know, we're talking about $190 million that had to be made in reparations. So, again, that's Iraq's statement. But in the documents, the UN Security Council, and by the way, this one is dated 18 December of 1996, they present their case. So I really believe that at this point in time, we need an unbiased, outside of the government investigation as to who started these oil well fires. Because I don't think it's clear. We never knew the UN Security Council was addressing these issues. We never knew that this was a subject of discussion. Everybody thought, oh, well, they set them. Well, their oil minister, Dr. Al-Hidi, immediately said that the Iraq did not have anything to do with the oil well fire. So I think it remains to be seen. And so what we're wanting is, has any information on the setting of the oil well fires, we want to talk to you, because I want to be wrong on this one. I really do. I do not want to think that we've been drawn into this, and this is one more story that fell from the Gulf War I. And so anybody who has any information on these fires can call 877-485-3838, 877-485-3838. And I beg that somebody will prove me wrong. But if anybody does have information, there's safety in numbers, and we do want, we just want the truth. That's all we want is the truth.
And, you know, in terms of this war, the current war, I mean, there have been charges, of course, that the U.S. also fabricated, or relied on fabricated evidence when Bush went before Congress or before the American people to argue for this war.
That's right. And that's what we're saying is, okay, if you lied to us then, are you lying to us now? And Department of Defense, I put my life in your hands, and I became ill as a result of it for a long period of time. Many of the Gulf War veterans have now died. I do not get paid a dime for what I do with the Gulf War Veterans Association. My purpose is I'm going to be the pain in the backside of the Department of Defense until they tell the truth about this illness, give real medical care to these troops, and stop this fraud on the American public. It is wrong. You do not manipulate your people into a war. Now, if we had been, you know, if Irvine had a missile headed toward it and they've got to fight these people, or they had troops headed to the shore, I would be the first one to be there.
Mm-hmm.
But not to go into 110 countries to try and, quote-unquote, create peace for these people, and not to do it on the basis of fraudulent information.
Yes, you think this is just the beginning?
Absolutely, it's the beginning. Absolutely. You know, I think Iran is next. I think the whole Middle East is going to be next, and that's why the Arab countries are now meeting and saying, you know, we got to do something about this because they have this on us over here. This war makes absolutely no sense. When I just read you a while ago about all those 100,000 different missiles, I mean, hundreds, thousands of missiles that were found that were loaded with chemical agents. Yeah, we had a problem during the first Gulf War, and you know what? They never told us once. Yeah, we told there was a quote-unquote threat of chemical weapons, but as a registered nurse, as a flight crew member, our unit was never told anything about biologicals. And we were never told that they might have this threat, and we had a much worse threat then. Our C-130 aircraft that we were trained in was supposed to go into the landing zone, which was near a forward hospital. Because of enemy fire, we wouldn't even shut down the engines. You stayed the plane stayed basically running. You got all of those patients out on stretchers, and you loaded maybe 50 patients. That's what we trained for, was to load 50 patients into that C-130 and take off in 15 minutes. It was done very, very fast. That would have been the time that we would have been exposed to biological agents from these troops on the front line. They never once told us about biologicals. And, of course, they never told us that the United States government sold those biologicals and chemicals to Iraq from 1983 to 1989. We sold botulinum, we sold anthrax, and West Nile virus. Those are three of the many that we sold. When I say we, it's the American Type Culture Collection out of Rockville, Maryland, that sold them to Iraq.
Hmm.
And when I talked with Colonel Hackworth, he said probably Donald Rumsfeld has a receipt in his pocket of those weapons. Now, he told me that several months ago because Donald Rumsfeld, as you know, went to the Middle East in 1983.
There's a picture of him shaking hands with Saddam Hussein.
Yes, and it lists him as a privoy of the Reagan administration, right?
Right.
Well, do you know what he really did at that time?
He was oil interests.
No, I did a background check on the man, and he was president and CEO of G.D. Searle Pharmaceutical Company, who had been involved in biowarfare. Also, what they didn't tell you, and Howard Teicher, excuse me, Howard Teichner, who was his assistant, has now said that Donald Rumsfeld was not in the Middle East for only 2 days to meet with Saddam Hussein. He was there for 6 months, and he met with every Middle Eastern leader that was sympathetic to the United States. What they also didn't tell us is they had been gassing the Iranians on a daily basis, but the United States said, hey, let's let bygones be bygones. Let's be friends now. Let's ameliorate our situation here, improve our diplomatic relations, and thus they did. At the same time, they continued to kill the Iranians and the people in Halabja in 1987. And so now we have the United States, who provided, and according to National Security Archive information that I've got, provided the helicopters, provided the mechanism for nozzles to gas them, and we calibrated their equipment. So the United States did it hand in hand with them, basically held their hand while they did it, and now we stand back, and Rumsfeld has the audacity to say, and he was killing the Iranians. He is a horrible, evil man. Well, guess who was there holding their hands? It was the United States.
And look at who's going to be benefiting from the reconstruction of Iraq. All the, construction companies that are tied to the cabinet.
And, there's where I have a real problem. I want to do everything I can in my power to try and get somebody with some backbone in the Congress or the Senate to say nobody that was involved in the creation of this would have a financial benefit, that exclusive conflict of interest. And if we allow these people who create the wars to go in and benefit and rebuild these countries, such as Dick Cheney is doing right now, that it absolutely should be illegal. Every American in this country ought to stand up and say, not no, but heck no, you are not going to go create a war and then mop up afterwards. That is so incredibly wrong.
And it's just amazing how much, how many missiles were dropped, in the last few days. And how much does one cruise missile cost?
Oh, I have no idea, but I sure bet that the Carlyle Group knows.
Yeah, and, look at all the needs in this country, the recession, the healthcare needs, the poverty needs, everything that's going by the wayside now because we are out on this crusade.
That's right, and we just cut the veterans' budget by $15 million so that they can forget about it getting any kind of meaningful care for sure. In this era of everybody flying their Chinese U.S. flag and saying support the troops, they have no idea what it means to support the troops. You've got a president. You have a president of the United States who didn't even watch the beginning of the war.
Actually, China's against Chinese government's against the war.
That's right.
Although the flags are made in China, but probably. But you have a page on your website called the Shame Page, mm-hmm. And you have these people. You say shame on them. And Michael Moore went on the Academy Awards stage and said shame on Bush. But you were saying shame on like the John Birches. Why?
Oh, John Birch Society has been attacking me for whatever reason, I don't know, but saying that all this information is basically false, my research is inadequate, and that I'm trying to scare people into the New World Order. Well, now, I don't get that one, but I will tell you that social society is a result of their failure to support the military. I sent them a letter, and I sent a letter to everybody. Please, somebody help these poor veterans. I can't do it. I need help. Please, somebody understand that the United States sold these biologicals to Iraq. Well, they discounted everything back in, I believe it was 1996. The letter's on there. You can go to GulfWarVets.com and see the letter from John Birch Society. And the veterans are furious at them. The veterans, they quit the John Birch Society in massive numbers. They want nothing to do with them because it's very obvious where their interest lies. And it is not with the veterans. The American Legion. Now, the American Legion is an organization that I used to think was the advocacy group for veterans.
Mm-hmm.
It is the organization to make you think there is an advocacy group for veterans. Now, you talk to a veteran. I've never found one veteran yet that's been helped. They talk about, we try to get bigger VA hospitals, and we try to get... But they have never been there. I've had dying Gulf War veterans that all they needed was enough money for a casket, and they couldn't get it. I have never seen the American Legion or VFW, and my parents are life members of both of them because both my parents were in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not. They're not there for the troops. And when you see that letter there that says, I'm trying to make people think there's a Gulf War illness from the American Legion, they refuse to allow us to use their facilities to hold meetings for Gulf War veterans to tell them the truth about the disease. And so you start to see who your friends are. But once you start telling the truth, you know, the heat comes on you, and you better be accurate, and you better have your facts. And I do, and they know that. And in fact, one of the Department of Defense physicians debated me on Pacifica the other a few months ago, and it was just embarrassing. It was embarrassing because he tried to play his game of, oh, well, you know this and you know that, and we've tried everything. And I caught him in his game, and it was really embarrassing for the Department of Defense because, ladies and gentlemen, there needs to be a criminal investigation into the failure to treat our military. Because if in time of war you fail to treat your military and you aid and abet the enemy, that is treason.
That's not, you know, this isn't the first time. Like, I mean, you said the U.S. did use chemical biological weapons in the first Gulf War. And you mentioned the depleted uranium. But in Vietnam War, the U.S. used Agent Orange, used dioxins. You know, people are still being born there with no legs, no hands.
That's
in
right.
Vietnam. Did the Pentagon finally admit responsibility for that?
They have admitted some. In fact, they have said that, oh, yeah, we did it, and we had no idea what was going to happen. Of course they did, ladies and gentlemen. Of course they did. Now, on the website at GulfWarVets.com is a classified document. Just go to the search engine and put in Agent Orange. That is a classified document that was never, never to see the light of day. It was written by Admiral Zumwalt in 1990, and it tells the truth about Agent Orange. So if you're an Agent Orange sufferer,
yeah,
my heart goes out to you. Go to that document, download it. It's about 32 pages. Download it. Take it to your VA and say, it's time we talk.
Didn't his son also suffer from it?
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
Yes, he did. You know, these people will suffer in silence, even if it's their own sons and daughters, and they will allow them to die, to suffer, but it is for the good old boys. I mean, they protect this. And just like Schwarzkopf now, I've had his own bodyguard who has confronted Schwarzkopf because his own bodyguard is extremely sick right now.
Wow.
And they won't budge. They won't budge. They can't, you know. They've got their retirement at stake. They've got their reputation at stake. They can't tell the truth. General Schwarzkopf literally lied during his testimony before the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. And you can go to our website where we have the video clip there of him. You will see him saying, I never heard of Camisea until 1996. That was the bunker complex. A little bit later, you have him saying, well, General Franks came to me, and that was Camisea he was talking about. I mean, he totally lied, and it was so embarrassing. But unfortunately, you know, we've got a situation now where there's going to be more troops that are sick. My concern is the safety and welfare of the new troops right now. We're trying to protect them, and we're trying to educate them.
You know, the you know, in terms of the current troops, a lot of them have been injected with anthrax vaccines.
Uh-huh.
Have they resisted? Is there a lot of resistance to that?
There's been an awful lot of resistance, but it has not met the media's eye because about 50%, for instance, of the Guard and Reserve pilots out of Connecticut quit, flat out quit. We are so far behind in the number of pilots based on the fact that they could not fly commercially later on. The FAA put out a statement that said if you had a reaction to the anthrax vaccine, you could not fly commercially. So all these Guard and Reservists who are weekend warriors, there's no way they were going to take that shot and even risk having a reaction. So academy grads, I mean commanders of units, they just walked. They walked from the military to try and protect themselves.
How many percent left?
I don't know. I honestly don't know right now. I haven't checked on that in quite a while, but I mean, a large percentage of the Guard and Reserve did quit. Now, a lot of the people have been brought up on charges of Article 15. They have been court-martialed. A lot of the troops are still trying to refuse it, and it's very sad. We've had outs, the anthrax vaccine, out-and-out deaths of healthy people, but they're not telling you this. And when you an excellent website is anthraxvaccine.net. anthraxvaccine.net by a physician who's trying to help out the military people.
Deaths even, really?
Wow. Oh, yeah, lots of deaths from it. A lot of neurological problems, multiple seizures. One vet was having about 8 seizures per day, and he was 24 years old. And he took the third shot, and his website is josephjones.net, josephjones.net, and his story is just absolutely so sad.
Well, thank you very much for coming up to the end of our time. We've been talking with Joyce Riley of the Gulf War, American Gulf War Veterans Association. Thank you, Joyce.
We salute you.
That was Subversely here on KCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on the show were not necessarily those of the regents of the University of California nor the management of KUCI. This is Dan Zhang signing off for Subversity.
He's 5 foot 2 and he's 6 feet 4. He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. Been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he always will kill it for me, my friend, and me for you. Fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA, and he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Laval? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon of the war, and without him, all his killing.
You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My name is Mark Hartz. You're listening to Music Issues